Welcome to 1572. The person you've called has chosen not to receive certain calls. A message can be left after the tone.
This is Gus. It's Peter Donegan for Charles Dowding. We'll try again in a little bit. Okay, cheers. Bye-bye.
Hello, you've reached Charles Dowding. Please leave your message and I'll get back to you.
After you finish your message, just hang up. Like a complete unknown. Like a rolling
stone. Hello, Peter.
Charles, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. And how's that sounding to you?
Yeah, that sounds okay.
Okay.
Yeah?
Well, if you're happy to proceed, I'm all ready.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, let's go for this.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
All right, it's another Friday afternoon. Charles Dowding, you're very welcome to the Sideshow. How are you, my good man?
Thank you, Peter. I'm very well this morning, thanks.
The title for your book is Charles Dowding, a Veg Journal Expert No-Dig Advice Month by Month. Charles, let's get straight into this because there is a garden talk that I gave a long time ago, and when I went back over the, let's say, from the 1930s to the 1950s to the 1980s, it seems to me in the old gardening books that I would have where it's illustrations more so, and for me, it was pre-things getting a little bit overly complex. It was a level above just throw the seed or broadcast the seed as we might have done way back around 1847. It was a step level above that, and it was probably around the time at which we got into producing more uniform crops, let's call it. And the opening line I have in one of the books, start by digging the ground 2 foot deep. And in an interview I gave some time ago, Charles, I said that at 6 years of age, with a month's worth of pocket money saved, I dug the ground 2 foot deep, placed my seeds at the bottom. I now know with horticultural education behind me how you might say childish logically that was, and at 7 years of age I therefore then had to identify seeds by their leaves only, which I now know were only ever going to be weeds. How far off the mark am I, Charles, by way of introduction on that? What led you to write this book?
Well, going backwards on those, I wrote the book because I have become a pioneer for no dig because I've noticed over more than three decades how well it works, and I feel I have enough experience based in the soil and on the plants I grow, not based in information gained in laboratories or in a what's called scientific way in modern terms, but more old-fashioned science where you learn by observing nature. And I've been doing trials, for example, into dig no dig, comparing results from dug bed and no dig, and always the no dig just does so well. And increasingly, as I have got older and got more experience, I felt I've really got to get this out there and share it and actually push and resist the conventional orthodoxy, which you allude to, which has made things so complicated, not always, but frequently, and daunts people or confuses them, you know, a little bit like your misunderstanding. Admittedly, you were only six, but nonetheless, I think it's quite funny that you drop your seeds in 2 foot deep, as if I've understood you correctly. And I can see how you might have thought that, you know, could be necessary. But what I'm always urging is simplification. You know, gardening is not complicated. The thing is just to understand the natural processes. And gardening, no dig, and growing a lot of veg, market gardening mostly, you know, the huge numbers of vegetables I've grown in my decades of gardening has shown me that as long as you observe closely, and that teaches you how things react, how things grow in your conditions, which no one else can replicate, you will learn what seeds and plants like. But you do need to be guided by just a few principles, and that's what I offer in my book, Month by Month.
But double digging, correct me if I'm wrong, Charles, double digging was a thing when I started horticultural college. Whether it was for you or not for you, that was the en vogue thing to be doing 25 years ago. Is that a fair point?
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. And I think we need to look at where that came from to understand it better, because from my viewpoint now, it makes no sense at all unless you happen to have, and this would be extremely rare, in fact, a massively compacted subsoil. I mean, extremely rare. I've taken over, for example, compacted clay that's compacted by tractors, which hadn't compacted the subsoil. It takes a lot to compact that deep down. And restored that soil with mulches on top, encouraging earthworms to come up and feed, and they make channels, and then they aerate and drain. And nature does it a lot better than we can do it. Whenever soil is disturbed or cultivated, you know, we get a temporary tilt, and then it slumps or settles, and you're back to square one or worse. So the double digging, I think, came from Victorian times, or maybe a bit earlier, when there was a lot of spare labour in big gardens in the winter. Maybe elsewhere too, but basically it was a winter job that most people could do, and a few people perhaps succeeded with it, and it's, I don't know, it just became orthodoxy. Whereas now, even the RHS are changing their tune and acknowledging the importance of soil life, because that's the bit that just got lost in all this advice. You know, what about all those worms and spiders and centipedes and other bugs? And not only them, but we now know through looking in microscopes about fungi. You know, soil fungi are probably the biggest organism on the planet, some people reckon now, in terms of weight, kilogram. And it's the wood wide web, which connects all plants and helps plants. If you don't disturb soil, you preserve the fungal networks, the roots team up with them, and then plants have better access to nutrients and moisture, because the fungi can go into tiny crevices that roots can't explore. So it just makes sense to leave it alone. Is that good?
But some people might call that, and I get where you're coming from, Charles, and don't get me wrong, we're on the same hymn sheet here, but I do get this impression that I never argued with my granddad, and if he said that's how he did it, then essentially that's how you did it. And there is that quote that, and again, I'll find the book that I used to give this talk on, and it said there is something about the British character of which the sound of digging suits. And I kind of agree with that people feel that if they go out into the garden and dig.
Yeah, but hang on, Peter, that's a discussion about character. It's not a discussion about soil. And, you know, what this is all about is getting the best from our soil. It's not us imposing our character on the land and hoping for the best, which is basically what they're saying. Do you think that's fair?
No, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And again, we're on the same page. But I sometimes get this picture in my head of the good life. There's a neighbour on one side and there's a neighbour on the other side of the fence. And one double digs 2 foot deep and takes that upper layer and puts it to the back and then goes down again.
Feels that
he's a better gardener than the other guy because he's not digging 2 foot deep. There is an element of that maybe about it.
Yeah, sure. I do get that. And I get that in comments to me sometimes, or, you know, when I'm called a lazy gardener or whatever the chosen phrase is. But it does come back to, it's a thing from the person. Or I'll get comments like, editor of a prominent gardening magazine actually said to me, I see where you're coming from with no dig, but I like digging. Yeah, that was his reason for digging. And, you know, really, I have to say, that's not a very good reason to dig. Yeah, why not go out and shovel a pile of gravel or something if you just want the exercise of doing that? Or maybe they like the look of it. But actually, when you get into no dig, especially with a compost mulch, you get a lovely look to your garden because it's all that lovely dark surface. And as well as having that nice look, you know that you have looked after all this precious soil life and fed all those organisms and microbes. And you know, and this is probably the biggest one of all, that you're not going to have many weeds. You have weed seeds that germinate from the compost you put on, that's for sure, which is why I recommend early hoeings in the spring when they're tiny. Just move them around more than anything. On a dry day, they're gone, so you can get rid of thousands very quickly. But then after that, undisturbed ground with a compost mulch, so it's being fed, it's happy, You know, I use words like that. When soil is happy, it doesn't want to grow so many weeds. And I know I can be shot down by scientists for bringing the word happy into it. But I do really feel that, actually. That's what it kind of looks like. And that's how I explain it. Because people often ask, you know, big question, how do you get rid of couch grass? Or how do you deal with couch grass? And the key thing is a light-excluding mulch, so 100% light exclusion, so the couch roots are trying to grow, but they only ever manage to grow in darkness, so they're not fed by any leaves that can't photosynthesize. So therefore, eventually the roots expire. Question is, how long does that take? Well, I find on average, within a year, you can still grow things, say, through polythene if you do it that way. Otherwise, compost and keep pulling the couch. But basically, what happens is, because the ground hasn't been disturbed, it doesn't make the same effort to recover with couch. And that's the key word, recover. You know, after soil is disturbed, it needs to recover, and it recovers with weeds, literally. And so no-dig mulching, you can get rid of, you know, really tricky perennial weeds altogether, 100%.
I'm reminded of my mother, who, before I started horticultural college, and she used to get me to dig the ground because she liked that fresh look to the surface of the soil.
Yeah, sure.
And I remember coming back from horticultural college and my mum saying to me, year one down, a qualification after my name at this stage of the game, and me saying, no, I'm not going to dig it for you, mum, because it'll only bring the weed seeds to the surface. And my dad came out to me and said, listen, forget what you learnt in college and just keep your mother happy. And I said, absolutely fair enough. And so that's exactly what we proceeded to do.
But that, Peter, that's a good illustration of how difficult it is to change things that may actually not, you know, there might be improvements, but people resist change for whatever reason, because they like how things are going. Quite understand that one.
Yeah, listen.
but with no dig, I am noticing now, you know, there is quite a significant shift. And in my case, I've really enjoyed using social media, for example, to put the photographs of my beautiful gardens. You know, I think they're a very eloquent example of how successful no dig can be. And that helps people, you know, not immediately, but sort of being persistent, changes are happening.
Charles, I said at the start of the interview that you needed no introduction, so I'll stick with that one. How popular is Charles Gowden?
Well, it's hard for me to say perhaps, but it's certainly increasing fast. And like the social media I mentioned, I'm putting a lot of videos on YouTube and they're being very well received and viewed. And I now have 50,000 subscribers there, which feels a decent, worthwhile audience to reach. Plus 30,000 on Instagram, and you know, just all those things adding up. And then I'm writing articles for magazines like Gardener's World and Gardening Witch, a big series coming out in 2019. And yeah, altogether, just lots of things are happening, which is exciting.
How many books have you written, Charles?
Well, 9 to date. And one, the latest one I co-wrote with Steph Hafferty, my partner, who's really into, as well as gardening, she does recipes and potions from the garden, that kind of thing. In fact, she's writing a recipe book now. But the No Dig Organic Home and Garden that we wrote together has proved probably the most popular of all, actually. It's kind of two books in one. And that's, you know, racing away, but we've printed 10,000, I think, now.
Well, okay. Second question then. How many garden talks have you got to do in 2018?
Oh, my word. I haven't counted them up, Peter, actually, but the list does look quite long. You can see it on my website under the events banner if anyone wants to check out when I'm coming to New York.
Well, I tried to count as part of my inverted commas research, which I rarely do, Charles, for the Sideshow. And I gave up by about March to put that in context. And I realised quite quickly that you are slightly more popular than me. I say just slightly, Charles.
Well, thanks for that. Nice endorsement.
Yeah, you're most welcome. You're most welcome. Let's get into the book, Charles. There are a couple of things that caught my eye, and I have to say it's a very fine book. But on the introduction, you do note, quote, although I do produce a lot of vegetables, I do not feel at home with machinery and have managed to scale upwards from a few raised beds, doing everything by hand as though still in a small garden. How much is a lot of veg, Charles, and why the no machinery?
Right. Well, I have used machines. The very first, I grew up on a farm and did tractor work and used the rotavator quite a bit, actually, and used the rotavator actually to break up the pasture, the sod, in my first market garden before I shaped up beds with a spade, and really enjoyed that. And then realized that if I was going to cultivate the soil again in any way, I'd need to use machinery on an acre and a half. and basically decided not to, and that's how I got into towards No Dig. But basically, I'm not comfortable with machinery, and I like the contact with the ground, yeah, and plants, hand contact. So I've developed over the years a method of bed gardening, not with wooden sides actually, but just slightly raised beds that you can scale up to. I reckon one person can do about an acre and a half, and that's how much I did in my first year, for example. And then I employed a person in the next year, and we did 3 acres and kind of went on like that. But now I'm doing a quarter of an acre, and I'm doing it more intensively. I'm using more compost than I did back in the 80s, and finding that I can get more crops that way from a smaller area. So I'm producing at the moment, I don't know what it is in tons. It's about a ton and a quarter of salad leaves in a year, and that sells for around £20,000. No, 18, I think it is. And I produce about £5,000 worth of other vegetables. So, you know, let's give you an idea. That's from a quarter of an acre. It's a very high output.
That's a seriously high, very impressive level of output, Charles. One of the other things that popped up on my radar, Charles, was in the Garden Media Guild magazine, of which I and you are both members. And there was a note in it at the start, Charles, and it was, I think what I picked up from it was, I don't want to misquote you, but you had suggested that there should be more coverage of vegetable-type gardening. And what I took from it, Charles, was that we do seem to go in times of frugality to a more grow your own style thing, and that is historic, going back over, let's say, 100 years odd. And in times of boom, or when the economy is coming back to the fore, we tend to buy flowers more rather than buying a packet of carrot seeds or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Is that a fair statement, Charles? How have you seen that go over the years?
Yeah, it's actually something that bothers me, because I feel it's so important to grow your own as much as you can. I think it's just the underestimation of the value of what's in homegrown food, because it can't be measured, I don't think, in monetary terms. You know, if you did measure the onions you grow in monetary terms, well, just forget it, because you're going to earn about 50p an hour growing those onions. But if you appreciate the extra flavour, the extra goodness, I can't prove this because I've not got the means to measure or analyze, but I'm sure there's more goodness in homegrown veg. And there's one other thing that is only just being noticed by nutritionists, which is the importance of microbes in our gut. And, you know, that follows from all the gut problems that people have nowadays. I hasten to add, you know, and I think that comes from eating a bit of soil. It always used to be said that we should eat a peck of soil in our lifetime. And I used to think a peck, well, that's not very much, doesn't sound a lot anyway, but in fact, a peck is, I think it's a number of bushels. You know, it's a volume measurement, it's a large amount. And the traditional argument is correct, because now nutritionists are saying or discovering, they discovered that you need microbes in your gut, and the microbes in the gut are nearly a exact replica of the microbes in healthy soil. So having your own garden, eating food from it, you are, as well as getting the nice food, you're getting the lovely microbes that maintain your digestion in good state and maintain your health. You know, a quarter or more of our brain is in the gut, so you will stay alert and bright and perky when you eat your homegrown veg. That's good, isn't it? That your listeners will like that.
You know, we could do it a lot more bright and perky people in the planet, to be quite honest with you, Charles. We could do it.
Yeah, well, I quite agree.
Charles, bring me back. And I know I jest in saying that when I was 6 years of age and I was digging the ground 2 foot deep, but where did it start? And this is a stereotypical question, but was it your granddad? Would he, in that question, have disagreed maybe with how you are doing things now? Was he of the double dig method?
My parents, going generations back, are farmers. And so they've never actually gardened, really. In this part of the world, anyway, farmers tend not to garden. So they're familiar with ploughs and discs and rotavators, which is what I grew up with on the farm. But in the garden, my father used to just hire a guy in the village to come and rotavate it. And, of course, they then had terrible weeds all year long. And he'd then employ the same man to come and do some weeding. But basically, he found it odd what I was doing, but my father was a very quiet man. He never criticized me or anything, and he could certainly see how well it was working. So, you know, I think he was happy. But my great blessing was that I did not go to college. You know, I have deduced everything And that's what I'm always encouraging other people to do. As long as you observe closely and do some reading around the matter before you begin, just so you're not really putting your foot in it. But, you know, do the basics right and take it from there. Learn as you go. So no dig, it just follows so naturally from how everything happens in nature. You know, where did you ever see double dug beds? Although it has to be said, obviously, where do you ever see vegetable gardens in nature? But the important thing then is to make sure that soil is rich. So adding compost, feeding the soil. Feed the soil, not the plants. That's a very nice motto to always have in your mind. And that simplifies things again, because you're not thinking in terms of, you know, this plant needs that or this plant needs the other. You alluded to that a bit in your introduction. You know, things have got so complicated, and it's actually really simple once you understand. And just keep it simple, then you will have few weeds, so you don't have so much weeding soil.
Charles, one of the things that you get into in the book, and I kind of like this, because you raised the question, what kind of beds? And again, through the boom, bust, we the handout of allotments after, in particular, World Wars, to the point where I would gauge around about 2007, everybody seemed to be almost going on this rampage of, I say rampage, it's probably overstated.
Yeah, sure. In a nice way.
Allotments became popular, and in particular in domestic scenarios, inverted commas, raised beds became a thing. You discussed that, and essentially it's, look, the not raised bed method also works, but it literally depends a little bit on what you are choosing to do.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as with everything, you know, it's the end user, the gardener, who decides the method that suits them best. But I'm always keen to point out, you know, where I see things happening that are not necessarily needing to happen, like with wooden-sided raised beds, because it, as you say, you know, it's often assumed that that's how you need to do it. And in fact, you can save yourself a lot of money by not having all those wooden sides, and you can save yourself a lot of slugs, because as, particularly if it's softwood sides, you know, as they decay after about year five, you get these pockets, holes in there of rotten wood, and that's where slugs hide. It's damp and dark, it's just perfect. They're, nothing can eat them, and then they come out at night and eat your veg. So people who've taken their beds apart following my advice say, wow, you know, God, that's so true. There were so many slugs hiding in that wood. And then it's much easier for them after that. So that's one thing I'm keen to point out. And then that goes with another thing that often gets missed, is about pathways. Paths are a valuable part of your growing space. You know, they're not just somewhere that you walk on. And to my horror, I sometimes see people putting gravel on paths and that kind of thing. You know, that's the worst thing you can do to soil, because you're not only adding nothing in terms of goodness, but it's then going to get gradually mixed in by worms and things into your soil. You just end up with a kind of gravelly, cementy mix in your paths or wherever you put the gravel. So I mulch my paths with first cardboard and a bit of compost or wood shavings, basically so that the weeds are dead. And then I've got clean paths. I keep the paths narrow. 15 to 18 inches is quite enough. That's, say, 35, 40 centimetres. And that way I've narrow paths, four-foot beds, say, 1.2 metres. And it's a nice, easy system to manage. There's no weeds anywhere, no places for slugs to hide, and pretty much guaranteed success.
So here's another thing then, Charles. In all of the garden talks I've ever given, the one thing I've always said to them is, look, when I'm handing out garden advice, the reason I know how you should not do that is because I've got it extremely wrong.
Yeah, well, good on you. Yeah.
Well, it's a college thing, you know. Yeah. When we did the experiments or trials, you would do it in absolutely nothing. You would do it in something, and you would do it in that type of growing medium. But rather than saying you should grow in peat treated with lime, it was, well, grow it in peat anyway and just see what happens. In your case, have you had as many successes as you have had failures?
Yeah, well, when I started out, I had a lot of failures. You know, like, for example, my first ever mulching for no dig was using old hay, because that's what a book I'd read from America, Ruth Stout's book, No Work Gardening. She used old hay, very successful no dig garden. And then I got loads of slugs. And then I thought, hang on a minute. And I went back to her book, and there's not one mention of slugs in there. And then I realized she's in a cold, dry climate in winter and hot and dry in summer. And they don't have any slugs. So that taught me the importance of not taking advice from any old ware, but make sure it's appropriate. But yeah, I have basically, I've not literally made every mistake, but most of them, I think. So I know exactly the problems, and I've learned the hard way, and that was back in my 20s mostly. So I feel grateful, too, to have, you know, been putting out this advice as a slightly older person and with the experience, like you say.
I won't say it's a bone of contention with you, Charles. I think it's on page 55. You have a thing on pricking out. I moved to the cell plug tray system when growing my own because I think working in garden centres, going through college again, 17 years of age, and spending eons upon eons teasing out trays of bedding plants and vegetables and putting them into, at the time, polystyrene trays or sets. How come you have a thing on pricking out, and why aren't you advising to use the plug cell tray system?
No, I advise both, you know, but where appropriate. For example, particularly multi-sowing, I recommend, you know, say 4 beetroot or 6 onion seeds per cell, sown direct, 3 pea seeds, whatever it might be. And that works a treat, and it's nice and quick. But where you want just one plant or something, say like celery, celeriac is a good example. I doubt whether you could succeed sowing celery or celeriac direct. I mean, do you do that? Because they're such tiny seeds, it takes so long to come up. So, you know, for certain seedlings, I'm recommending it. And the advantage for me of pricking out certain vegetables is that you can germinate hundreds or have many you want, you know, in a small area of your seed tray. And that's the germination phase is when you need the most warmth, the most perfect conditions. And so it's easy to give that extra warmth to large numbers of seedlings, say on a windowsill, you know, whereas if you'd sown them direct, you'd have lots of module trays on your windowsill. Whereas if you sown in a seed tray, you just got a small area, a small amount of compost kind of getting in the way.
Charles, one thing I loved about the book was that it allows me, should I pick this book up in 2019, in 2018, in 2020, take, let's say, what is it, week one, the first week of July, you've got how to grow landcress, how to grow purslane, how to grow onions, and then it goes into July week three. And in between all of that, you seem to have the tasks and the jobs that one should be doing. If I was to write a personal diary over my now 35 years in horticulture from when I first grew seeds and rammed it all down into one book, this pretty much would be it. Is that a fair synopsis of what you've created here?
That's nice to hear. Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for pointing that out, because it's something, again, I'm always encouraging, and I don't know where it comes from, really, the sort of old belief, or it's certainly a belief that's out there, that you have to sow everything in April and then kind of walk away and come back whenever to harvest. And if sowing happens all through the year, there's always jobs you can do. You can mulch or make beds at any time of year. You can start at any point. So yeah, if that gives you a nice entry point, then that's brilliant. I'm delighted to hear it, and I hope your listeners will find the same.
Well, it's a funny thing with a podcast, Charles, that people will be listening to this in 12 months' time or in 6 months' time. And yours kind of says to me, well, Peter, if you are starting your garden, if you're a new couple, if you're a new to horticulture and you're 50, 30, 12 years of age, and you walk out in the middle of July, August, September, March, you literally pick it up and go straight to that chapter. Is that a fair way to describe that, Charles?
Yeah, absolutely. I would read the introduction first, maybe. But basically, yeah. I mean, and just go for it. You know, don't be afraid. I'm always saying that to people, because they, I think they've been too cowed by all the so-called, you know, official advice that's out there, which, yeah, quite a lot of it, to be honest, is not correct. And that's why I wrote another book called Myths. But basically, yeah, you know, just go for it a bit, and always just aim to understand the principles of what you're doing, and have a bit of fun with varying the details. Because when you have fun gardening, and as we know, as we get older and we dare to try things, it's surprising how often these new things work.
And that is exactly the key to it. Make sure and have fun gardening. The book is The Veg Journal. It is expert no-dig advice month by month. It's published by Francis Lincoln and written by Charles Dowding. Charles Dowding, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Well, and you, Peter. Yeah, so go to all your listeners, I would say. Go and grow. Thanks.
For those of you listening at home, if you're stuck, if you're on the road, if you're traveling, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesideshow, sideshow.com. All of the details will be up there, the show notes, the links, etc. And if you have a local bookstore and they don't have Charles' book in stock, do ask them to order it in for you. And that is all we have time for. Have a great weekend in the great outdoors, and we will talk to you soon.